Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The producers of this podcast recognize the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
That was really when I started to see the marginalisation of those officers. The vast majority didn't feel anybody cared about them. They felt totally unvalidated for what they do. And so there's this sort of like dramatic dichotomy between the danger that they lived and worked in, the psychological and physical injuries that they are experiencing, and yet this view that no one gives a staff.
I can't really truly imagine what it's like to be in a job where you have to be vigilant all the time, being ready to attend to traumatic and unpredictable situations. But that's what prison officers have to do every day. Our guest today is social worker and therapist Bruce Perham. He's worked with hundreds of officers and he's written a book called Code Blue, Prison Officer in Danger, about trauma and PTSD in these first responders. Through the course of his years of going in and out of prisons and hearing the day-to-day experiences of prison officers, Bruce came to understand that he was dealing with professionals expected to run towards unpredictably dangerous situations at any moment in the course of a workday. It's a high-risk occupation, and it's one that we, as a general public, don't really know much about. Hey, Bruce. Lovely to talk to you today. So you're Bruce Perham, and you've written a book called Code Blue, Prison Officer in Danger, and it's a really interesting, quite gripping book about the role of prison officers and the fact that they are often subjected to, you know, a lot of trauma and danger in their role. But before we talk about that, Bruce, tell us a bit about who you are and your background in leading up to writing this book.
Absolutely. I'm a mental health social worker, family therapist and narrative therapist. Very few people have ever heard of the narrative. About 13 years ago, I decided to start working privately for a whole variety of reasons. One, just to be free and not to be working within systems. And a friend of mine was working at an employee assistance provider company, and he said, look, shoot in your CV and we might take you on, which they did. And it was not long after joining them, I was sent out to a prison to do what is called a critical incident debriefing. I was called into this prison. It was pretty early in the morning. It was about 6 o'clock, and a prisoner had taken their own life and in very stressful circumstances. And so the aim of the session was really to sit with the officers that had been involved in that. And I didn't know it at the time, but I know now how traumatised officers are by those experiences. And so we just sat together as a group talking about what they'd been through, what they'd experienced. They shared a lot with each other, which, you know, was really, so important for people to have the opportunity to talk through those reactions.
So up until that point where you had your first real encounter with a prison environment, what had been your work like to date? Because you've been a social worker for a number of years.
Most of my working life had really been spent in chronic health and disability. And I'd worked at the MS Society for 15 years as the senior social worker there, and moved from there to work at Alzheimer's Australia, working with people that had a family member with dementia. So in moving into private practice, it just meant it was going to be different type of work, and it just evolved that in going into the prison, and then I actually started to go into that same prison monthly to see officers in the prison, which I still do the 12 years later, and a couple of other prisons as well. So it just sort of evolved that I was going in and out of prisons a lot. And what that then led me into is that whole world of trauma and trauma reactions. And also through EAP, I saw a lot of police as well. Haven't really referenced that work that much in Code Blue. I focused on prison officers, but in seeing police and prison officers, there's a lot in common in terms of the degree of trauma they get exposed to. So it just engaged me, actually. I just got more and more interested in the impact that this was having.
And when we talk about EAP, we're talking about employee assistance programs that organisations have available for their employees. But when you had that first encounter where you were talking to the officers who had been involved in the situation in the aftermath after a prisoner had taken their own life, were you prepared for that? I mean, what was the extent of the kind of trauma incidents that you had dealt with in your career thus far?
I dealt with different types of trauma. You know, a diagnosis of MS for people and their family members is often very traumatic, to, in particular, it's a young person's disease, to be told, you know, in your 20s that you have an incurable neurological illness. But it's a different type of trauma. So, you know, I'd certainly sat with people that were very full of grief and quite traumatised by, you know, what was happening to them. This was a different type of trauma, but I certainly remember knowing very little about, I knew nothing about the work of prison officers. So I was certainly very aware it was going into an environment I knew nothing about. But probably you just develop a capacity to do that, you know, and I still go into situations where I know nothing about the context of what I'm going into, but you just sort of learn to sit and to listen and to respond to what people are saying. So, yeah, I knew when I came out, I thought this is a whole different world of what these officers had to do.
And as you did more visits to the prisons, was that mainly to support prison officers?
Look, it was not solely prison officers. It was really anybody that worked in the prison. And it's probably, you know, as a general comment, I've also learned that everybody that works in a prison is affected in some way. And a lot of different staff have shared that with me. And So it's not only those that are the officers that are working directly with prisoners, but you know, everybody's impacted in some way. As an outsider, prisons are very isolated workplaces, and they can't get out for lunch because it just takes too long to get in and out of the prison. So they don't go to meetings. They never leave the prison, and so they're quite dark environments in terms of you know, very few people come in and out of a prison. You know, so they're not normal workplaces, and to me that adds to. It adds to the complexity of, you know, their exposure isn't like normal workplaces. You know, they don't get exposed in the way that we get exposed to different experiences. So there are lots of things like that that really, you know, sort of hit me as being quite different. And yet when you'd say that to people, I'd say, well, we didn't even think of that. It's just what we do. It's the nature of the job. But it all kind of makes it a very unique workplace.
When was it that you started to really begin to think or understand that, you know, there's something here, this is a cohort of employees who are particularly vulnerable to trauma, to PTSD? What were some of the things that you were picking up in your dealings with them?
It's a really good question. I reference it in Code Blue in terms of that in 2015, a couple of staff from one of the prisons, an ops manager and the training coordinator, contacted me and talked to me about their concern about the impact that, in particular, the self-harming of the prisoners was having on staff and they're dealing with that. So they asked me whether I'd be interested to put together a training program for that. And one of the officers said to me, but don't come out with your overheads. You lose my officers if you come out with an overhead. I just want you to come and talk to them. And I just want you to come and talk to them about their mental health. So what I then decided to do was I did a series of focus groups with about four groups of 10 officers at that prison, where the idea of that was I was just going out to sit and talk to them about, tell me about what it's like to be a prison officer. And they did, you know, they shared what it was like. And I then went away and developed sort of a handout, I'd call it, on managing stress and dealing with trauma. It was sort of, in a way, when I was putting that together as a training program, the riot occurred at the remand centre in 2015. So it was after I'd started to put that paper together. So I spent a lot of time out there. I spent about 3 weeks in the 5 weeks following the riot, sitting with officers that had been highly traumatised about that experience. And then in 2016, a wonderful man in the department got funding for me to run this training program in the 4 high security prisons. So that was 10 sessions in each prison. So that was 40 sessions. I probably sat with more than 500 prison officers. You know, we all have stereotypical views of what prison officers do, but you know, in a way, I was given an insight into there's just so much more complexity here than what I'd ever stopped to think about.
And when we talk about the prisons you work in and the particular riots we're talking about in Melbourne, and people will be quite aware of that vision of seeing prisoners up on the roofs, and it was quite chaotic. Can you tell us a bit about what actually happened during those riots and some of the stuff that you were hearing?
I can generally, because there's lots of general points come out of it, and particularly from a trauma point of view. And I often kind of say to people, I don't look at things from an organisational point of view, I look at things from a psychological point of view. And there was a lot came out of that, that I had nothing to do, no involvement with, but in terms of how to, you know, prevent that from happening again and how to rebuild that prison and all of that. And I know nothing about that. But from a psychological point of view, that, and I've learned it over and over again, that the more you feel in fear of your life, the higher the psychological reaction to it is a really broad generalization. So that even though, which is a miracle, you know, nobody was injured in that riot. I mean, I think someone might have done an ACL knee injury, or there were some prisoners that were might have had concussion. You know, there were really minor injuries came out of that riot. And it was, it could have been 15 people could have been killed, you know, it could have been a terrible outcome. But in a way that doesn't mitigate the psychological reaction that officers had that genuinely were in fear of their lives, and even though it turned out okay. So the ramification of that for a lot of the officers was it was beyond the scale. You know, that they are used to working in danger. You know, they know that's a part of their job. The riot was off the scale in terms of the prisoners were in control of the prison, and they had weapons, they had bulldozers, they had all sorts of things. So from a psychological point of view, you know, nobody had ever been through anything like that, and it could have got unbelievably out of hand, and it was just fortunate that it didn't. So it was just an off the scale experience, but because of the fear that the officers had of what could happen to them, it was psychologically really traumatic.
Yeah, and I think I mean, obviously prison officers are working with a traumatized cohort of clients, I guess. The prisoners are their clients. These are people who are, you know, traumatized, unwell, dangerous in circumstances. So it's not your usual people that are your customers, so to speak, are they?
Absolutely not. And I do talk about that in the book. In you know, there are some very psychiatrically ill prisoners that and there's a well known that a lot shouldn't be in the prison system, but they are because there's nowhere else for them to be. And obviously, you know, prisoners that have a high capacity towards violence to each other or to officers. So, you know, they do deal with a very difficult client group, if we want to put it like that. I really need to be clear, not all prisoners, it's some prisoners. You know, some prisoners are very compliant. They know they've done something wrong. They know that they're in prison. They know that they need to do their time, and they do that cooperating. You know, it's just that not everybody is that predictable, and events happen and things happen, and officers have to be able to deal with that. So, but it is a very challenging group of people, and in some of the units in the prisons that say have those prisoners and deal with those prisoners, they never don't have a sense of danger, or, you know, and it's probably certainly make the point in the book, they're a very hypervigilant group of people because their work demands that they be hypervigilant. And anybody that's done that type of work, you can't turn that hypervigilance off. And so most officers would acknowledge that where you and I might run at, you know, 70%, 80% at work and 40% out of work, they run at 80% 24/7. And a lot of this stuff just sort of goes unnoticed. It's sort of like it gets put down as, well, it's the job, and it is the job. But, and not just in it with correction officer work, any first responder work, there's often really not the analysis of, well, what is the psychological impact of this work over and over again. There's often very little discussion around any of that. And yet, probably due to being going in and out of the prisons for so long, where you start to see, you know, the long-term impact. It's very much what Code Blue's about in terms of, okay, there's just a lot here that we need to be far more aware about.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken to, you know, a number of people for Australian True Crime Podcast about post-traumatic stress disorder, first responders. We also know that we do have prison officers listen to our program, and we've spoken to a former prison officer a number of times, which is an incredibly popular episode because they were talking about the old school stories of Pentridge, you know, the crims and those kind of stories that we're really interested in. But
I guess it kind of masked maybe the seriousness of the kind of work and the danger of the kind of work that was being done. Is that what you have found, that prison officers may downplay what they do day to day because it's just too hard to explain to people?
Look, absolutely. In a lot of officers will say, and they're right, they can't take it home to their families because it's too traumatic. And the book referenced that in terms of Neil, the officer that I'd known for a long time. And I think there's a wonderful bit there where Anne just says, I can't deal with this anymore. Don't tell me about that serial killer. I just can't deal with it anymore. So because we're dealing with top end trauma, really, and as I've said to a few people, you know, I haven't put the worst examples in the book. I've gone maybe upper middle. I could have put of what officers have shared with me, higher levels of trauma. So it's not that I've elevated what's in the book. I've actually tried to not overwhelm people with the level of what officers deal with. Any officer that reads it will go, well, yeah, there's worse than that that we deal with. So we're kind of really confronting off the scale trauma experiences in all sorts of ways. And it, you know, and I guess what I'm reflecting is it's not really understood. And it is a bit like what you said, you know, if you, and the other thing I'd say on the, because, you know, Neil worked in Pentridge, he comes from those old Pentridge days, you know, that the system has changed enormously. And I had to tread very carefully on in terms of how the situation was dealt with in the Pentridge era, as opposed to how it's dealt with now. And there's been huge transformation of that. So a lot of those older prison officers will tell you the system is now totally different. And the book picks it up because it's, I've had a few people say to me, well, the book's anti-management. And I say, no, it's not anti-management. It's reflecting what the officers have told me. So that needs to be dealt with in terms of that's what a lot of officers have told me, that in terms of how they feel the, you know, they've missed out in a way in terms of that, yes, that the rules have changed and in many ways quite rightly, but the mental health of the officers hasn't kept up.
Bruce, you mentioned Neil and his family, and he does feature quite a bit in the book, his story. It sort of seems to be very representative of experiences of prison officers. Can you tell us a bit about Neil and how you came to know him?
I actually, and this is what any counsellor reading the book will, you know, pick up the fine line in terms of our two wives worked together, you know, like 30 or more years ago. So I got to meet Neil through that, and, you know, we'd have a barbecue, we'd go out to dinner, and he'd talk about his work. And I never really fully understood, you know, back then, you know, it was sort of like, I'd sort of think, oh, wow, you know, that's amazing. It was when I started working at the same prison, and I'd bump into him from time to time, and that's all in the book. And then on one occasion, he came to see me and he said, can I see you? I really need to talk to you. And then we just worked out, well, look, as long as it's only about work, because I knew him, you know, personally. I can't talk to you about anything else, but I can talk to you about work. I was comfortable to do that. And so then I saw him several times in some of these work related incidences. So from a counselling point of view, you know, you could really take the high ground and say, oh, well, I shouldn't have done that. It's unethical. And probably writing the book is unethical in a way. But I just made the decision that, you know, you say to me, you know, I'd rather talk to you than someone I don't know. And I think that's a huge issue for officers. And anyway, so we had these conversations, but what it enabled me to do was, in a funny sort of way, which I saw as a good thing, it made me far more aware of when I felt that he was really starting to go under. And it gave me an insight into that that I might not have got if I hadn't known him so well. And certainly it enabled me to go back and interview him for the book and he was very keen, and his family was very keen to do it. But and a lot of it didn't make the book, you know, from an editing process. But it was very hard for him to relive some of that stuff, and psychologically, I had to back myself that I could support him through that. But there'd be psychological critics of going and doing those interviews with him. He would now say that that it was really helpful for him, although at different times he said he just wished he could have bashed my head in because, you know, when you revisit trauma, it's painful. And I'm really aware if people can read the book, and if they've been traumatized, it brings that back. And I've had to have a belief that painful in the short term, beneficial in the long term. And I think Neil would say that he got a lot out of those interviews. And I know that his wife, Anne, did as well. Because, you know, and I touch on it, the family experience is totally hidden. And yet all these first responders, you know, police, prison officers, they go home to their families, and their families have to, you know, manage the short fuse and the trauma reactions. And so it was really, in a way, quite a privilege to sit with them and talk about that and about Neil's PTSD and how he dealt with that.
Have you had good supportive interactions with your training and with the book? I know it's only just out, but with, I guess, management? Because, look, we all know that management is pretty much doing the best they can with what they have got and understand, and with the confines, within the confines of a lot of factors. But how have you been received, I guess, by the upper echelons of the industry?
Look, it's in the way the book's confronting, in all sorts of different ways. And it's hard for, I've had some feedback, not a lot, but it's confronting in terms of what needs to be done and the amount of work that needs to be done to really provide the level of support that people need. And in also, you know, generally that there's a lot of focus on post-PTSD, that officers and police and people experiencing PTSD get the support and get, you know, proper support. The jury's really out in terms of, okay, but what do we do while people are experiencing these jobs to minimise the risk of them developing PTSD? And look, as a general point, you know, they're all essential occupations. We need prison officers, we need police, we need fireys, we need nurses, we need all of these occupations. But if you step back and look at it, as a byproduct of people doing these occupations, they often end up psychologically damaged, severely sometimes, which PTSD is a severe, you know, situation to deal with due to them doing their work. So we need these occupations. I think historically the need to have them has kind of blinded us a bit to the increasing awareness of, but in actual fact, this work is psychologically damaging. And in Code Blue, I've put in a little bit of the neuroscience from Dr. John Arden, who, as I mentioned, the book that I met. You know, there's increasing neuroscience awareness around exposure to accumulative trauma has major consequences. We know that. Anyone that's got PTSD will tell us that. And it's not criticism, it's just reality. The need to deliver the service has become more the focus than, well, but how do we support the people delivering it? Now, everyone will say, oh, but we're doing everything we can, and they are, but it just needs to go a lot deeper. We really need to, and it will be resources. You know, how do we give prison officers a sense of validation? That's not going to be easy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I was going to ask, you know, we know that first responders are police, you know, medical staff. Prison officers obviously are first responders, but you don't necessarily think of them in that way. And you do say in the book that they're probably on the lower rung of that awareness of first responders. Why is that?
I think because we don't see it. I mean, I only got an understanding of it because I was able to go in and have access to what they do and also to sit in those critical incident debriefings and hear what they've experienced. And so I was very lucky, very privileged to be able to get the exposure to what they do. And I would have not had any idea of... you know, before going in there, I wouldn't, you know, just drive past a prison and go, it's a prison, you know. So I think because it's isolated, you know, in a way, if you look at other first responders, you know, you see the police attending things like Bourke Street, you see the fireys attending the fires, you know, at the moment, we're getting a lot of exposure to the trauma that the nursing and medical staff are experiencing. So it makes it a lot easier to go, oh yeah, that would be so hard, you know, in that type of work. Whereas we don't see, we don't hear or see of anything that prison officers do. And 80% of what they do is confidential. So they can't tell you, oh, well, I was here or I did this or I was involved or I was there when that prisoner came in. All of that's confidential. And they're bound by confidentiality through their employment. That they're not able to tell people and they're not able to go public. And so how would anyone know what they do? And nor can them, you know, management or the department are not in a position to be promoting what prison officers do. So it's just an anomaly of the fact that you put all the factors together and no one knows what they do. And I think that what we do read is the negativity of what they do, you know, like with the recent IBAC report, you know, those cases of corruption or, you know, whatever. And you know, and that's what IBAC is for, to investigate that. And that all needs to be investigated. But, you know, sometimes I think when people read that, they then go the next step and go, oh, they're all like that. And I was actually telling a long-term colleague, so what are you doing these days? And I said, I do a lot of work with prison officers. And she commented, well, they just take drugs into them, don't they? And I said, well, maybe one or two do, but there's about 6,000 prison officers in this state. And I can tell you, you know, 99.5% go in and give their everything to what they do. And I think as Neil reflects in the book, that I think a lot of officers will relate to, I think at one point he says, we wear our losses hard. When we lose a prisoner, there's no joy in that. We wear it hard and we will go over and over and over and over did we do something wrong? And he gives an example of that with I think all of that's just not seen, and it needs to be seen, but it's very hard to get it seen.
Yeah, I know. Look, when we spoke to the former Pentridge guard, I mean, we were joking around a bit with some of the stories, but, you know, they are quite serious. And I actually had an off-the-record chat with a prison officer a little while ago who, works as a prison officer and said people just don't understand the kind of stuff we do, but also mentioned that, yeah, when something goes wrong, when you hear of a prison officer doing something like, yeah, taking drugs in or, God forbid, having some sort of relationship with the prisoner, it's really hard to take because it then kind of makes everyone think, oh, well, you know, they're just all off doing it and they feel angry and betrayed.
Well, and that adds to the complexity. You know, if you look at the moment in what we're seeing, you know, the excessive force, you know, and it's certainly very topical at the moment in terms of, you know, what's happening in the community and do officers use excessive force, do prison officers use excessive force. But that doesn't encompass the fact that, you know, these are highly complex psychological environments to work. And I was thinking the other day, you know, in the situation where someone does use excessive force and, you know, and it was rightly investigated and all of that, you know, there's very little in terms of, well, what was happening there when the person used excessive force? And if you actually then look at the long-term exposure to trauma, I mean, I'm guessing, but I would guess that the wearing down of resilience, the repeated exposure to dealing with these traumatic events, and then you go into a highly traumatic scenario where quick decisions have to be made, that officers are not always going to get it right. And, you know, in a way is when someone uses excessive force, is that sort of connected to the burnout, the exhaustion, the, you know, not thinking straight. And it's, you know, when you talk to officers that say, I'm not quite sure like right now, but certainly back in 2016, where they could do 7 to 10 shifts in a row, or be rung up on a day off to go, can you come in? We're short staffed, and they go in when they really shouldn't go in because they actually need the time off, but they go in. And on day 8, near the end of a shift, you've got a code where you've got to arrive there. You're fatigued, you're exhausted. You know, maybe you 2 weeks before you're involved in a traumatic experience, and then you've got to make an on the moment decision about how things are going to be dealt with, knowing that if you get it wrong, you will pay a price. And so I just think there's not enough attention paid to, well, do we really need to be more aware of when officers might be starting to get to that point where there's more intervention strategies, rather than they just go into a situation where they don't handle it in the way that they might have.
And it's particularly important because the prisoners who the prison officers are looking after are particularly vulnerable, and they do need the prison officers to be at their best, essentially, don't they? Because, you know, they need their care and their oversight.
Absolutely. That takes me into another general point. And look at that. I'm only talking from my own perception. You know, I don't access what thinking is within these fields. It's really my own perception. But there's a high expectation on prison officers these days to role model, mentor prisoners, to be a critical point in the rehabilitation, you know, process. What Code Blue does is raises the issue that that's not working. And, you know, and yes, there's no doubt that prison officers, that a prisoner will spend, you know, I don't know what, but 96, 97% of their time will be spent with prison officers. So they are critical in that role, but it's been an expectation put on them rather than it's one that I think, has really understood, and Coberly is pretty blunt in terms of the vast majority of officers don't see that as their role. Some do. Some are very committed to case management and really want to work more with the prisoners. But the vast majority don't. And I was doing a session at a rural prison with senior prison officers. And we almost had a bit of a laugh, you know, when one of the officers said, well, yeah, my staff hate doing them. And it's what's called their case management. They sit with the prisoner and they work out, you know, goals and stuff like that. He said, my officers hate it. And I have to tell them they have to do it. And then he said, in actual fact, when you think about it, the prisoners hate it too. So everyone had a bit of a laugh about his two people that hate the process sitting together to work out something. Now, you know, if you step outside of that and you think, well, no change occurs if two people don't want to do it. And so what I'm really trying to say in Code Blue is, well, that needs to be addressed. You know, if we're talking about rehabilitating prisoners and we're talking about that, you know, the main responsibility of that's going to rest with prison officers, well, then we can't have them at such low morale. They actually need to be recognised for the skills that they have. And I often say, no one will read prisoner behaviour better than a prison officer. And, you know, their capacity, you know, and I sit in the unit sometime and I watch them scanning and I watch them working out, keeping an eye on what prisoners are with other prisoners and what's happening. You know, they really have a lot of skills that are just not utilised and nobody even bothers, you know, to ask them. So if we're ever going to get anywhere with rehabilitating prisoners, a lot more attention needs to be paid to the people that we're delegating that responsibility to. And there's a bit in Code Blue where Neil references that, and he references his despair at seeing these prisoners come back and how he'd really thought that maybe they're going to make it this time, and they come back.
Now, you also detail in the book, you went to the United States and did some research, had some meetings, and that was very interesting to read. And it sounds like, you know, America's probably around 10 to 20 years kind of ahead of maybe this thinking. I'm not sure how successful it is in application, but can you tell us about some of the stuff that you learnt over there?
Look, it was really interesting to do it. And I can't exactly remember how I came across Katerina, and you know, I mentioned her in the book, Katerina Spinaris, but someone informed me of her course that is actually, it was called From Correction Fatigue to Fulfillment, and I was the first counsellor that ever went and did it, that it's a peer education training model, so she trains prison officers to go back into their prison and deliver this training. In going over there, I mean, it's a brilliant training program, and she picks up the issue of correction fatigue, which we would probably more call burnout here. And then the second half of the day is on, you know, what some of the ideas around, well, how do we turn this into being a fulfilling career? And so it's a great training model, and there's nothing here like it. And it's her, just reflects out of her 20 years of doing, you know, this type of work, and the pain that she's seen over the years of the work that she's done through the centre that she set up. So it was really, she's quite an inspirational person to look at that, her recognition of it, and so really matched what I was, you know, feeling here. And I guess one of my hopes out of the book will be that training gets more picked up, because you know, we need to be doing more of that type of training. We need to. When I did the training in 2016, and I sat with these groups of officers, every group, and I mean every group, back then, and I really don't think it'd be much different now. And COVID over the last couple of years has been no training. So every group said to me, we have never sat together in a group and talked about our mental health ever. And I believe them. And so So that, and there's a lot of practical reasons and shift work, and you know, there's a lot of reasons why training is difficult within these environments, and I understand that. But the bringing people together and actually talking about their experience, and then in as a group, you know, looking at ways of, well, how do we deal with some of these issues? You know, how do we deal with some of these, you know, mental health issues? And just while I'm on it, you know, if you look at the one of the key things in the trauma literature is preparing people for what they are stepping into. And I had a police officer say to me years ago, he said, you know, joining the police force is like going into a railway tunnel, but no one told you a train was coming. And I think that so captures, and I'm not criticizing necessarily, but you know, make a difference, you know, come and work for us and make a difference, make a contribution, you know, because these industries need to recruit, you know, and they do, obviously. If you've got people going out at the other end that are, you know, PTSD and traumatized and high turnover, you can't argue that there's not high turnover in these populations. You have to keep bringing new people in. Well, if you had a promotion campaign about, you know, read code blue before you go and be a prison officer, I'm well aware half of the people wouldn't go in and be a prison officer. But somewhere there needs to be a fine line between you need to know what you're stepping into.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that because I thought, well, where's the opportunity to give people a realistic assessment of the kind of work that they will be going into? Because, yeah, as you said, no one goes in thinking X, Y or Z, but, you know, what we've heard from many people we've spoken to with PTSD is that it's exposure to multiple traumas. You know, someone may encounter a few traumas in their life, or I don't know, every trauma is different, but these kind of careers have multiple, you know, could be daily.
Absolutely. And so you've got that whole issue of, well, you want people to take these occupations on, but what do we need to provide them to be alert to several things, you know, the need to look after themselves, you know, and often I do sessions with graduates, prison officer trainees. And it's very difficult for them when you don't know what you're stepping into, unless you've been in the police or military. It's very hard at the beginning to know how you're going to manage. Anecdotally, people tell me that probably about 50% of the trainees leave within the first 2 years. Now, I've got no idea whether that's true or not or what, I don't know. But I do know a lot of officers will go, this isn't for me, you know, this wasn't what I was cut out to do. I had one officer say to me, he was very honest, he was pretty new, and he said, you know, mate, when you do a cell count where all the prisoners have to stand outside their cell, and he said, when they all just stare at you, he said, it's the most unnerving thing you can ever experience. And yeah, a lot of officers would say, I don't even think about that. But it captures that kind of, and he said, I can't cope with it. It's just too much for me to cope with. So I think he was certainly going to, you know, get himself out into something else. So I just, you know, it's the same mantra. You know, these things need to be looked at, and okay, how do we do this better? How do we prepare officers for the things that they will need to be able to do? And that what, you know, and I often say in terms of I need to get the new trainees, we need to sit with them at 3 months, at 6 months, at 9 months to give them an opportunity to review how they're going when they got to the first trauma event or their codes or how are they going with that, to get some discussion. It's difficult to do within the structure, but if you're looking at how do we do this best, you know, in those early couple of years, you really need to be talking about your reaction to events, to process them, because a lot of the examples that come out down the track in Code Blue, and I talk about it in terms of officers that disassociate. So if you do it long enough, and I think I put it in about, you know, the officer that was very about, they cut their legs off, cut their arms off, and cut anything off, I don't care. And I really thought about that comment, you know, if you're so disassociated from it, because that's the only way you can deal with it, and you never talk about it, there's just a risk that it all gets bottled up and then people don't talk about it, but they disassociate from it.
If you could unpack that a bit more for me, that disassociation, because it sounds like, you know, it's a protection mechanism, but then it's not useful to that officer and it's not useful to the prisoners either, because, you know, they need the care and the attention. So can you just explain a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. Because of the, you know, and the system has really led itself to the get back on the horse in the prison Pentridge days, or jump back on the horse, don't let the crims see that they've beaten you. Neil talks about that, you know, if you get your nose busted, get your ribs busted, get back there, bandaged up as soon as you can, show them that. So there's this whole thinking around the getting back on the horse so that you move on, you don't process it. And it's been extraordinarily difficult for him to process the emotional reactions, because we shelve them and we don't, you know, we just shelve them. And then what happens is you've got all of these experiences that start to mount up. And probably all of the officers, police or prison officers that have got PTSD, talk about the trigger. It's why I talk about the trigger so much in Code Blue, because we just become vulnerable to a trigger. And, you know, the number of officers, prison and police that I've sat with that have said that was by no means the worst situation I've been in, but it's undone me and I don't know why. And it's a little bit like I might say sometimes, you can be okay on Friday, but you're not okay on Monday. And it can happen that quick, and the wheels can fall off that quick on a one event that's just been the icing on the cake or the one apple too many. And then it's just this rapid breakdown of psychological reactions. And generally, officers are not ready for it. It's come out of the blue. They didn't see it coming. And then suddenly don't know what to do. You know, how the hell do I deal with this? So, you know, really now no one is going to say now bottling up is the way to go.
And you've had your own lived experience with, you know, mental health and trauma yourself. And you talk about that in the book when you were a younger man. And what is it about doing this work and also processing your own experiences? What have you learned? What are you most passionate about letting other people know?
Really good question. Look, it's a variety of things. The reason, and I did think long and hard about, you know, would I share my story? And the main reason that I did was that I thought any prison officer with PTSD or police officer would identify with some of it. And the main point I wanted to make, which matched what I've seen, was I had no idea what was happening. It is so deeply psychological. I worked in the field. I had no idea of what was happening to me. And it took me a long time, as I talk about, to really get an understanding. And there were times I would sit there and think, this is me and this is my head, and I've got no idea what's going on. I've got no idea why I am distressed to the level that I'm distressed. Because at that point in time, I thought my life was going okay, pretty much. You know, I kind of knew... you know, I knew that Leanne was there, but I would have said I had a pretty good high school. You know, maybe it was a bit depressive, but I had generally been pretty fine. And then, you know, one home visit, and I've lost control of everything for, you know, many years after that. So I shared that just in terms of we can't always understand what is going on, and that's the complexity of PTSD. Or of any major depression, you know, we don't always know, because, you know, our brains are just so complex. So partly I just reflected that in terms of, well, I've mentioned Simon in the book. I think he's got a quote on the back page, you know, that He got back to me and he said, well, but, you know, you have to give more hope. I guess the hope is that we can work these things through, you know, as difficult as they are. But we need to shift how we see PTSD. You know, we need to see that as, in a way, people that are paying the ultimate price, you know, for the work they do. And that they have a lot of experience about paying a price, and I think have a lot to offer in terms of what needs to occur, of how they could have been supported better.
And you mentioned Leanne and you mentioned Simon. Just tell the listeners who you're referring to.
Leanne is my twin sister who died when I was 2.5 of leukemia, and I can't remember her. And certainly in me talking about that in the book, it goes into that in terms of the impact that had on me. A lot of it I wasn't aware of, really, and I wouldn't, in actual fact, in a different way. It's very different to what prison officer police go through, but I hadn't really processed any of it. How could I? I was a kid. But it, you know, it really psychologically devastated my mother, and I was very much a part of that, of which I had no real understanding of. So, you know, that was taking all my life to work that out, but that was a huge personal experience. And in going into counselling, if you look back, I was vulnerable from the beginning, and, you know, at risk of a trigger experience that I didn't understand, you know, when it came along. And in terms of Simon, that's a colleague that I'd worked with for many years at one of the prisons that I went to. And I utilised his objectivity in writing the book. And he was the first person I sent a copy to, because one thing about writing a book, I think I had it right, but you're not sure that you've got it right. And when Simon got back to me and he said, you know, you brought, I think he said that I couldn't sleep that night after I'd read it, that you brought back to me the power of working in a prison. And he actually said that people had said to him when he left the prison work that people that leave the prison work have a process of detoxing from it. He wasn't a prison officer, he was a counsellor. And he said, it's right, you know, it brought back the trauma for him of the work that he was doing. And so that, you know, I really learned from that in terms of, well, you know, this even people that aren't prison officers still are traumatized by the work that they do. And that's Simon.
And finally, when you were introducing yourself, you mentioned something called narrative therapy. Can you explain a bit more about that?
I certainly can. Narrative therapy was pioneered by Michael White and David Epstein. David is from New Zealand. Michael is from Adelaide. Sadly, Michael died of a heart attack in 2008. He was at that point known all over the world for his narrative ideas. Basically, what narrative is that people are the experts on their own lives. So I learned from him over many, many years the importance of listening to the story, not judging it, but hearing it. The 2016 was very much about me not being the expert, but I was there to listen and to hear the officers' stories and to respond to that, which is quite different to what in, say, psychological field is often called psycho-ed. You know, we're the expert, we'll just tell you what you're going to go through. So it's a very different approach, very much based on people talking about their own experience. But Michael had a deep belief that everyone is the master of their own story, and you just need to hear it, and you need to help them, to support them, to, as he used to say, make these discoveries about themselves. So I was highly influenced by Michael and his magical way of looking at human experience. And so Code Blue is written very narratively. You know, this is what people told me, this is what I heard. And then I've added my own responses to that in terms of, and look, sometimes I'd sit with prison officers, and I'd be saying, you know, you guys have got a very complex job. You've got a very demanding job, and you know what you do, the level of skill that you need to do it is significant, and almost have argument. Oh no, that's wrong. No. It's just what we do, you know. And yet what you do is extraordinary, but you have to stop and listen to it.
Well, Bruce, the book is a fascinating read. I mean, I think not only for people who work in this space, but for anyone really to understand a bit more about people's experiences. And yeah, thanks for chatting to me today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And as you've probably gathered, I could talk for hours. It's a topic of a great passion of mine. And if we can get more awareness, it's just awesome.
Thanks to our guest, Bruce Perham. There's more information about his book, Code Blue, Prison Officer in Danger, and the work he does in the show notes. If you've been affected by anything discussed in this episode, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. As always, thanks for listening.
This has been another Smartfella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.